Good afternoon. It's just about 3 o'clock. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Thursday, the 18th of September, the year 2014. Jeff Rafter here on a Juneau afternoon. It's me, Tom Thornton. This week's CUAS Evening Meeting Speaker will offer previews in his presentation. We're talking to Ben Huff about his new book, The Last Road North. Beth Weigel will be here to highlight the upcoming library activities. We'll hear about local arts activities with our regular feature, Arts Up, with Ariel Rolfe. With the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers, low temperatures 41 to 49 degrees. Forecast for Friday, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has settled long-standing legal claims against the U.S. government. With more is Troy Wild with New Mexico News Connection.
The Obama administration is paying a record $554 million to settle legal issues with the Navajo Nation over claims that the U.S. government mismanaged the tribe's money and natural resources for decades. Rick Abasta with the Navajo Nation says the settlement is about more than money, though, in that it helps to rebuild a wounded relationship.
Well, yes, I think this would be a good step toward establishing a solid relationship between the two governments and to build upon that for our future generation.
Abasta says Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley is planning a series of town hall meetings to gather public input as to what to do with the money. He says it could very well be placed into a trust fund that would generate revenue to help fund various projects. The 15-million-acre Navajo Nation, the nation's largest in terms of land size, stretches across portions of New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. Most of the land is held in trust by the U.S. government, which handles the leasing for oil, gas, and other mineral extraction, as well as for farming and grazing. Wynn Hornbuckle with the U.S. Justice Department says a top priority of the Obama administration has been to settle legal disputes with tribes all over the country.
The federal government has focused considerable efforts on the remaining tribal trust accounting and trust mismanagement cases and has been able to resolve these claims without the need for more litigation for almost an additional 40 tribes. That's a total of 80 tribes and a total of over $2.5 billion.
Hornbuckle says the settlement with the Navajo Nation is the biggest ever paid to a single tribe by the government to resolve a land trust issue. A ceremonial signing of the settlement agreement is scheduled for tomorrow in the Navajo Nation capital of Window Rock, Arizona. I'm Troy Wild.
A federal judge has ordered the state of Alaska to take additional steps to provide voting material to Alaska Native voters with limited English. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
In her 8-page order, U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason lays out steps the state must take to improve voting materials for Alaska Native voters with limited English. Corey Mills is a spokesperson for the state of Alaska. She says the state is committed to doing everything that was put forth in the judge's order.
It's nice because the court gave us really clear guidance, and so with that clear guidance, we can put forth these additional tools to enhance the language assistance program in the state.
The lawsuit brought by several Native villages alleged that the state has failed to provide accurate, complete translations of voting materials in Yupik and Gwich'in. The state argued it had taken reasonable steps. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, or NARF, who argued the case on behalf of the plaintiffs. She says the gist of the 21-point order is that the election information that English-speaking people are receiving must be made available in Yupik and Gwich'in. That includes all radio announcements about deadlines, information about all the ballot measures, and information about judges. And the entire official election pamphlet that is printed in English must be available as well.
Not only that, but all of this information has to be reviewed and adjusted to make sure that it is understandable by all Yupik dialects, from Yukon to Hooper Bay Chivak down to Billingham. So it's an extraordinary remedy, and we're really grateful that the court has taken the effort to order them to do this. This is exactly what should have been occurring all along.
All this has to happen on a tight timeline before the November election, and the order includes deadlines, some as early as this Friday. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
If you are a Native American, there's one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native business. Go out and vote on November 4th. Voting on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Go to nativenews.net for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guest is Dr. Thomas Thornton. He still lives here in Juneau, but currently he's in England as the director of Oxford University's Environmental Change. He's here to take part in some workshops and also talk tomorrow night at the evening Egan presentation at 7 o'clock at the Egan Library. Tom, thanks for coming to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff. It's nice to be back in Juneau.
So what brings you to Juneau here? You've been talking about indigenous languages and also Anthropocene. Now I'm going to leave it to you to define Anthropocene.
Okay. Yeah, I'm back partly on a research trip and partly doing some lecturing with the Resilience and Adaptation Program at UAF and then down here with the Fisheries Program. And I'm finishing that off tomorrow night for the Egan Lecture with I hope was a provocative title called Raven, Rocks, and the Anthropocene, A Bird's Eye View of Future Earth. And the concept of the Anthropocene is one that probably people have heard of, but they might not know a lot about. But it's a declaration by scientists that we've entered a new geologic epoch, which is something that doesn't happen every day, usually about every 10,000 years or 100,000 years. And this new epoch they've named for humans, because humans are now the most significant driver of global change, propelling the planet into a new geologic epoch. And scientists haven't reached a consensus on whether or not they want to adopt this new name to define the geologic layer that's being produced by human activities or being heavily influenced by them. They're going to vote on that next year. But in the meantime, the concept has gotten some popular attention and has become a concept, you might say an organizing concept for understanding a whole lot of what's going on planet Earth. And so I'm interested in the concept as a popular concept and how it speaks to people.
We may think we're important, but we're just another layer.
Exactly. Although by calling this new era the Anthropocene, we're saying we are the most important. So some people see it as an act of hubris of humans saying we are predominant now and giving us license maybe to engage in more major engineering of ecological systems and of the Earth itself, geoengineering, for example. And others see it as the Anthropocene as a wake-up call that we have to actually be more humble and leave less of a footprint in all kinds of ways, from the fossil fuels that we shouldn't be burning because of the CO2 that they emit, which helps warm the atmosphere, to the chemical pollution we're putting into watersheds and oceans, to the tremendous biodiversity loss that's happened just within the last 100 years. So all of these things are products of what we might call the Anthropocene. And in that sense, I think it could be a useful concept for people to understand all of these different changes that are happening on Earth.
You probably have a ready answer for this, but why should we care?
It's a good question. I mean, normally labels don't mean that much, and we can argue about the semantics of labels, but I think we certainly should care about this phase in human development, because we're approaching a population of 9 billion in the next few decades, and we are experiencing record levels of inequality amongst different populations, and the promise of bigger droughts, warmer climates, producing less crops that we've been able to produce under temperate conditions. And so there's a series of crises that are predicted in the areas of water security, food security, energy security, particularly with fossil fuels maybe becoming more scarce. And so there is going to be a sort of conjuncture of these issues. Some people call it the perfect storm. Others call it the nexus, where all these things come together. And the question is, what does it mean? How do we understand it? And then how do we respond to it? Because we're obviously going to have to adapt whether we like it or not. And I think that's the interesting thing about the Anthropocene is you can argue about whether it's the right label, but if you believe that humans are having an increasing impact on the Earth's fundamental processes, then we do have to have a strategy for responding to it.
Your press material talks about your main interest in research interests are in human ecology, adaptation, local and traditional ecological knowledge, conservation, coastal and marine environments, conceptualizations of space and place, and the political ecology of resource management along the indigenous peoples of North America and the circumpolar north. That's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words, and in some ways the Anthropocene brings a lot of my research interests together, and I'm sort of happy to talk about this issue, particularly in the Northwest, in the Northwest coast, and in Southeast Alaska, which is really one of the most dynamic environments in the world in terms of its geological changes, glaciation, deglaciation, populations that had to move because of natural disasters and changes in climate. All of that has happened here among the indigenous peoples over the past 10 to 15,000 years. And so in some ways, thinking about these issues through the Northwest coast can be very enlightening. And so that's where the raven comes in. How do we narrate something like the Anthropocene? Do we have any precedent in our history? Well, people would look maybe to the Great Flood as a narrative of destruction and humans having to build an ark, if you believe in the biblical version, and start anew, essentially. But there are lots of other narratives that also I think are instructive to look at in the context of rapid and major environmental changes. And the ones I'm interested in and we'll be talking a little bit about tomorrow night are raven narratives, because we have this marvelous character of the trickster demiurge raven with a capital R who steals the sun and steals fresh water and redistributes these resources in new ways. And the interesting thing about Raven is that he is a disruptive force and an unpredictable force. And in that sense, I think he's instructive, because a lot of what we face in the future of the Anthropocene is unprecedented and probably unpredictable. But he's also a character who, shall we say, doesn't understand the consequences of his own actions. And in that sense, I think raven narratives are also useful, because some people think we can manage our way out of the Anthropocene by major acts of geoengineering and other things. And usually in raven stories, Raven has similar ideas about how he'll manage things, but they're usually unintended consequences and knock-on effects that he doesn't anticipate, which he then has to adapt to. And I suspect it will be the same way in the Anthropocene, and it's probably not a wise idea to adopt a confident managerial attitude that we can engineer our way out of this. Certainly there's a place for that, but there's a place for being ready for the unexpected as well.
Studying the Anthropocene, the 21st century abelian arc?
Yeah, one could look at it that way, I think. I mean, the fact is the effects are going to be differential, and not all of them may be catastrophic. I mean, that's the other thing about the Anthropocene that I think is relevant from raven narratives. Even the great cataclysms that he experienced or that he caused indirectly through various acts often presented opportunities, and it was how he capitalized on those subsequent unexpected opportunities that made for adaptation, or how the people responded to those opportunities in the wake of Raven's actions. And I think we'll see the same kind of novel environments in the Anthropocene, and the question is, how are we going to respond to them?
You led a workshop yesterday on indigenous place names. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, indigenous place names is a topic I've been interested in for over 20 years. And a couple of years ago, I edited a book, an atlas, on indigenous place names in Southeast Alaska. And the workshop I was involved in yesterday was really carrying that work forward and looking at some of the ways that place names might help us better understand ecosystems in Southeast Alaska, both micro ecology and the macro ecology of the region. And I was particularly interested, I've become particularly interested in how densities of place names, that is to say, where along the coast we find high densities of indigenous place names, might correlate with things like ecosystem services that are now important to document and value, sources of food, places where carbon is sequestered, places where there's a regulation of climate and water flow to prevent flooding and so on. These kinds of sites are sometimes marked in the indigenous toponymy, the place name distributions. And in that sense, I think we still have more to learn from them besides documenting their locations and meanings.
Was there an aha moment you had when you were growing up that made you decide this is what I want to do with my life?
Yes, probably. I used to travel in Canada. I used to lead canoe trips, and we used to camp on a lake which had a native name. It was Temagami, which meant deep waters, which was very descriptive of the fact that the lake, I think, was 1,000 feet deep in places. But we also used to camp at a place called Seal Point, and that name didn't make sense to me because you don't generally see seals in freshwater lakes in interior Ontario. But in fact, it was what was called a manitou, or a spirit, and there was a story associated with it, but it wasn't a real seal. It was a spirit seal, you might say, or a manitou. And from then on, I've always been sort of curious about place names, because they can lead you astray sometimes, and you might think, what does this have to do with what's actually there on the site? But usually, if you dig a little deeper, there's an interesting history to them.
I've been talking with Dr. Thomas Thornton. Mm-hmm. He'll be leading a presentation tomorrow night at the Evening Egan Library, 7 o'clock. It's free, and it's brought to you by the University of Alaska Southeast. Tom, is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, I just hope to meet a lot of old friends, hopefully, tomorrow who come out to the lecture. And it's really been a pleasure to be here and also to be back in Juneau.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 25th of September, 2014. It was on this day, 1789, Congress passed the Bill of Rights, 12 amendments to the Constitution to protect the basic rights of U.S. citizens. It's the birthday of the sports writer Red Smith, born Green Bay, Wisconsin, 1905, columnist for years for the New York Herald Tribune, and after that, the New York Times. Red Smith, who wrote, 90 feet between home plate and first base may be the closest man has ever come to perfection. It was on this day in the book The Kane Mutiny, the warship the USS Kane runs aground, and Lieutenant Commander Queeg blames the mistake on his helmsman. It's the first in a series of mistakes that cause his crew to lose respect for him, and eventually they decide to mutiny. It's the birthday of Shel Silverstein, Chicago, 1932, cartoonist for Playboy magazine, and then popular children's author. His book, Where the Sidewalk Ends, has sold more than 1 million copies in hardcover. It's the birthday of the man who first translated Proust into English, C.K. Scott Moncrief, born in Stirlingshire, Scotland, published his first volume of Swan's Way in 1922. And it's the birthday of William Faulkner, born in New Albany, Mississippi, 1897. Started off writing poetry, went off to New Orleans, where he met the novelist Sherwood Anderson, who worked in the mornings, and in the afternoons they walked together down the streets of New Orleans. In the evenings they sat together over a bottle of whiskey. While Anderson talked, Faulkner listened, and Faulkner said, I thought that if that's the sort of life being a writer was, then that's the life for me, that I would become a writer. So Faulkner began his first novel, Soldier's Pay, came out in 1922, and 5 years later wrote his first book set in Yoknapatawpha County. the Sound and the Fury, followed by Light in August, followed by Absalom, Absalom, which begins from a little after 2 o'clock until almost sundown of the long, still, hot, weary, dead September afternoon. They sat in what Miss Coldfield still called the office, because her father had called it that, a dim, hot, airless room with the blinds all closed and fastened for 43 summers, because when she was a girl, someone had believed that light and moving air carried heat, and that dark was always cooler. Here's a poem for today by Jonathan Galassi, entitled Once. The train has left the station. You can't take it. Once the promise has been broke, you can't unbreak it. If the letter has been sent, you can't rewrite it. If the cigarette's been smoked, you can't not light it. Not the candles snuffed, you can't see by it. Once the seat's been sold, no one can buy it. The phone is disconnected, don't talk to it. The window's painted black, you won't see through it. The scotch tape end is lost, you can't unwind it. The earrings in the lake, you'll never find it. And now the money's squandered, you can't give it back. And time is short, you have to live it. A poem by Jonathan Galassi, Once, from his collection Left-Handed, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:22, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Jeff Brown filling in on a Juneau afternoon. The announcement about tonight's Red Rob Cohen Jazz Group concert, it's sold out. A waiting list will be started at 6:30 for a first-come, first-served basis in case there are any no-shows. For those of you who can make it, don't worry, the concert will be available soon on 360north.org and also KRNN FM. Once again, that's tonight's Rob Cohen Jazz Group concert at 360 is sold out. A waiting list will be held at the door 6:30 on a first-come, first-served basis. I got my tickets.
Yeah.
Ben Huff, thank you for coming down the station.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Jeff. Good to be here.
Ben Huff has just released a book called The Last Road North. He's a teacher at the University of Alaska Southeast, and he's here in the studio to talk about the book. And it's not really out on the shelves yet, is it?
It's not. It was actually released in Europe. It's a German publisher that's handling the book, and they released it in Europe last week, and it's not released in the U.S. until the spring, but with the European release, I get an allotment of copies that I can sort of sell prior to the U.S. release, which I'm taking pre-orders now, and they'll be here in a few weeks, and I can start mailing them out, so it's sort of exciting to have this first sort of effort be friends and family and other photographers and local folks, and so far the reception's been good.
Large amount of just fantastic pictures, all about the Hall Road, the Dalton Highway.
Yeah.
First of all, how did you get interested in photography?
I studied art as an undergrad, and not particularly photography. I was more interested in painting and drawing, and spent a great deal of time away from the camera, and found my way back to it maybe 12 years or so living in Colorado. And shortly after I picked up the camera, started making pictures again. My wife and I moved to Fairbanks in 05. And that landscape, this place sort of, it sounds really cliche, but sort of changed me in a way that sort of shifted the trajectory of what I was doing, and it's sort of everything now in sort of a short span of time, actually.
How does the camera itself, as a piece of technology, work or interface with the subject?
I don't really think about it as technology in a lot of ways. It's for this particular work, I used a large format film camera, and it's not to say that I'm averse to digital at all, but...
when you say large format?
4x5 inch negatives, so a big cam with bellows and a hood over your head, sort of in the style of seeing pictures like Ansel Adams or Timothy O'Sullivan or Carl Watkins. And that camera was certainly something that with portraiture, slowed down that event. It became something that was a bit choreographed. It became something that was much less sort of something that maybe the sitters felt a little bit more considered. And it definitely becomes a tool in that scenario. Landscape maybe a little bit less so, but it's I sort of view it as a tool. I'm much more interested, I guess, in pictures than I am in cameras, if that makes sense.
Your book features the Dalton Highway.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like 500 miles?
Yeah, just under 500 miles, about 500 from Fairbanks. The road itself is technically 414, but from Fairbanks, just under 500.
Did you decide to take a bunch of pictures of the highway before or after you went on it for the first time?
My wife and I actually made a trip to the Arctic Circle in, I guess, late 06. That's what you do as tourists, and I was sort of struggling to find what I was looking for photographically moving to Fairbanks and really confused by sort of my ideals of what I thought Alaska was and the space that I was seeing out on hiking trips and pack rafting trips and kayaking trips and then sort of the reality of a lot of the infrastructure and things that we've done to the land. And that trip just a quarter way up the road changed things for me. That road became sort of the complication that I was looking for. I say that it's sort of the physical and psychological line between wilderness or frontier and oil or resource extraction. I love that idea of that sort of dichotomy, that complication, everything that I was sort of struggling with being new to Alaska, sort of reconciling for myself of what this place is, that road embodied or does embody that question for me.
How many pictures did you take? And you went on several years.
Yeah. So it was a several year trip. I was much more frugal with the 4x5 than maybe I am now with 120 or with digital. Hundreds, if not 1,000 pictures. 56 in the book. It's a tight edit. I want it to feel sort of like a short story in a way, sort of narrative based as much as photography can. It's very loose. A loose medium for storytelling, but it's 56 pictures out of, hundreds, maybe 1,000 sheets of film.
Do you manipulate the pictures at all, or do you just crop it in a creative way?
I don't. I mean, I try to, the goal is always obviously to get the picture in camera. And there's certainly, contrast and color, and I scan the film and I print it digitally, so there's certainly things that I need to do in post to sort of smooth things out, but it's no more than you would do in the dark room in a conventional analog setting.
Now some pictures are just full of color and some pretty much monochromatic.
Yeah, I think the most difficult thing in editing a project like this has been dealing with different seasons, different light qualities. The interior and then sort of the fogginess of the north and the Brooks Range and different seasons. We tried to make it a little more subtle. And then I did include some black and white pictures as well, just a sort of series of typology of crosses that designate deaths of truckers on the road since 1975, I guess, a way to sort of nod to them in a way that I don't really with the rest of the pictures.
Other than a couple, a foreword and an afterword in the book, there's not a lot of text in the pictures. It just has a mileage indicator. And if you want to find the title of a picture, you have to go to the back of the book.
Right, yeah. And it's certainly by design. I mean, I want the pictures to do the heavy lifting, There's an essay, an introduction by Barry Lopez, a conclusion by Karen Irvine, who's the director of the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago. And, Barry definitely sets a tone and Karen definitely sort of provides some context at the end. But I wanted the pictures to be sort of unencumbered and to let them sort of exist themselves. And ideally, I would love to have people get to the end and see the captions and see the map and read Karen's essay and be drawn to go back to the beginning and start the journey on the road again is I guess, my hope. Every photographer that's made a book's hope, I guess, you know.
How did you connect with the publisher?
I met Alexa Becker, who's the acquisitions editor for Kara Verlag, who's the publisher. I met her in Portland at a portfolio review, an event last April. And her and I have a couple friends in common, and I know now that she knew the work going into our meeting. And I had made a full-on handmade maquette of the book, so I had a physical object to hand her and say, this is what I want to make. You know, I know that you can help me make it better. And she, to my delight, she understood it. She got it, and she was excited about it. And we decided pretty quickly to do it. It took a long time, obviously, to make it happen. But that would have been a year ago, April. Yeah.
The book is arranged going north to south and south to north, depending on which way you start the book.
Right.
In fact, it was in my second reading that I discovered that there was actually an indication of whether as far as mileage was.
Right. Yeah, it generally starts in the south, and there's certainly some sort of meandering along the way, but it starts in the south, ends in the north, starts a little warmer, ends a little colder, obviously ends at the oil fields at Prudhoe Bay. I mean, that's the physical and metaphorical end of the road, obviously. And the little indications of miles and the map at the end, those are all things that, it's funny, I received a few advanced copies, the one that you saw, and as I watch friends, as I watch people look at it, it's those little things that sort of they discover later, and it's, I love that about it. You know, it doesn't force you, but it asks you, I hope, to sort of go back and reinvestigate and to look at things again, and that sort of up and down across the road, starting at the south, the north, or whatever direction, that movement is something we tried to create in the book, and I hope it's been successful.
I guess I probably don't need to ask, but I'm going to anyway. Is it all available light?
What's that?
All available light shots.
Absolutely, yeah, yep. No strobes at all, just the 4x5. Yeah, all available light, of course.
After shooting hundreds of thousands of pictures, how did you make up your mind which ones were keepers and not?
Yeah, so I mean, I always had the book in mind when I started. I mean, this was always the end artistic object. This was always the sort of the finale. And I would take, you know, pictures up the road with me to sort of make pictures that fit and things that I sort of wanted to work. But at the end, it was printing every one at 4x5 and pinning them up on the wall and putting them out on the table and putting them on the floor and pasting them into sketchbooks and just beginning to see them as pages, to be able to see them, how they work together, how they informed each other, how two photographs, three photographs might speak to one another, which is completely different than eventually, you know, dealing with them as a PDF. Or dealing with them as prints on the wall, or deal with them as single photos, that dealing with them in mass and ultimately ripping up all but 56 of them, you know. It's a long process that takes time, and I have some very close friends to me that can be objective, that editing something that you have to, I mean, I own it 100%, but I've had some two or three people that I trust a great deal that have sort of helped me sort of work through it from time to time.
And when is the book going to be available here in Juneau?
It'll be a release, U.S. release in April, so it'll be at Hearthside and maybe the City Museum and other places, certainly in the state, in the spring. If folks are wanting sort of these early ones, my website, hufffoto.com, I'm doing pre-orders, and then when I get those books here in a few weeks, I'll be mailing them out. If you're a friend that's listening and you want to avoid the shipping, give me a call and we'll work it out. You know, but yeah, I'm anxious to, you know, these that'll come across on the barge and then come up AML and arrive here in Juneau, probably November, early November. I'm anxious to get them out into the world sort of prior to a larger U.S. release.
Ben Huff, University of Alexis East instructor and also a great photographer. Ben, thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate your time.
This is Bird Note. We might not always realize it, but our lives are intertwined with the lives of birds. Sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes directly. Poet Kevin Black explores this relationship in his piece, A Swath Uncut. The reader is Dominic Black.
With a sharp blade and sharper eye, Alf split the field the way he combed his hair, with a single swath down the middle. Alf, who cared about appearances, with perfectly symmetrical fieldstone piles and his farm implements lined up like soldiers on parade, left a swath uncut. An incongruous strip of number one Canada wheat, east-west across the field, a ship's wake on a stubble sea, a precise line to intersect the south-flying eye of a lead goose and draw it down on fluttering wings like first white winter flakes, old friends spiraling in to feed and chatter and come again. What flawed logic in a man who would crop the very tops of his fence posts to bring in a shower of geese and let not man nor dog raise them? A man who had killed more geese in the hungry dry days than any man alive, and yet killed not one since.
Juno Arts and Humanities Council is thrilled to announce Season 41. The excitement begins with the United Kingdom Ukulele Orchestra and continues with Emmy Award-winning choreography, slam poetry, Mexico's leading brass quintet, comic books coming to life on stage, Juno's favorite Motown show, and ends with legendary comedy by the Second City. Tickets available at jahc.org, membership, season, and flex passes at 586-ART.
Time is 3:36, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on the Juneau afternoon. Beth Weigel is sitting across from me with an update on library activities.
That's right. There's always something happening at the Juneau Public Library. And we've got a couple things happening just tonight and tomorrow that are pretty exciting that I wanted to invite people to. So tonight we've got our back-to-school resources for parents night at the Mendenhall Valley Library. It'll start at 6:30, and it's a great opportunity for parents. If you can leave baby and children at home, that'd be the best thing. But, of course, you can always bring them to the library. There's lots of books for kids to read while you're in listening to the various presentations on a lot of our databases and different resource materials that will help your child in their school year. And particularly homeschool parents and parents who are working also with their kids at school can learn a little bit more about all the different kinds of things we have available. Some of the ones we'll go over tonight include just doing basic searches, including how to place holds and suspend your holds and do some basic functions like that. And then we'll get into some of the databases like Live Homework Help and our testing educational resources. Live Homework Help is exactly what it sounds like. You can reach a live tutor. One of those tutors lives here in Juneau, but they're available throughout the evening and afternoons when your kids are doing homework. And if they get stumped or have a question, they can connect with that person and they can get immediate feedback. So that's a really great resource. And if later on in the year your children are preparing for an ACT or SAT or something like that, or even adults who are looking to do the ASVAB or something along those lines, the testing educational resources, we've got a lot of those tests, practice tests and things like that available in that database, and that's a really huge help. We've got other databases that are particular to kids, so teaching your kids how to use Searchosaurus and our KidSearch, BrainPop, those are some of the popular ones that we have on our website, as well as Novelist for K-8, and that's a great one. If your kids are really into series and they're looking for similar kinds of series that they're, you know, interested in, if they've done the Lemony Snicket and they really love that, or they've done all the other series in the Reardon novels and they want to get onto something similar, that's a great database that helps you find similar styles of writing and books. And we'll also have a little look into our teen health and wellness. All kids go through various different kinds of growth spurts and have questions about things that maybe you're not sure how to answer. That's a great resource for looking up all kinds of information about health and wellness. We've got some great history and genealogy databases. I think a lot of kids are asked to do a variety of ancestry sorts of projects in school, and a new one that we just added that I'm pretty excited about is called Points of View, and it provides parents and children who are working on a research paper, maybe trying to help them with their research paper, look at both sides of an issue. So there's some of the difficult issues that you may be hearing about in the news, and they want to kind of hear both sides of it. That's a great resource to go to hear both sides and find more information, understand how to appropriately cite sources and things like that. So then finally, we'll go over our Mango languages, and that's a great way to learn a new language. And so,
what's a Mango language?
Mango language is a database on our website, and you can access it from home, and you can go through a variety of lessons. So let's say you wanted to learn Spanish, and so you could take the Spanish course, and it takes you through a series of lessons on that. So it's a great resource for learning a new language.
Sounds good for any age.
Any age, exactly. So that's happening tonight at 6:30 at the Mendenhall Valley Mall, and then at our library inside the Mendenhall Valley Mall. And then tomorrow, since the kids aren't in school tomorrow, we've got a great program happening at the downtown library. It's called Yes, It Is Rocket Science, and we'll be video chatting with the Museum of Flight in Seattle, and they will give us a little history on rockets and how they're constructed and how they're able to fly up into space. And then we'll actually build some rocket prototypes out of soda bottles, 2-liter soda bottles, and we'll head outside after we've got our prototypes built, and we'll launch them. So it'll be pretty exciting.
You'll be going to the moon, is that correct?
Well, they probably won't go quite as all the way to the moon, but we hope that they'll go up into the air, and it'll be a fun test. You can, you know, there'll be some variables that they can account for and their payloads, and we might even provide some other challenges along the way. But we want to give a shout out not only to Museum of Flight, who we've done another program with on robots, and that was really great. It's working with the OWL system, which is part of the online with libraries, with the state library system. Parks and Rec, Risk Management, and Docks and Harbors all gave us approval to head out there to the area that's right now the tourist bus parking area. So that's where we'll be launching our prototype rockets and seeing what happens in our experiments tomorrow. And that starts at 1 o'clock. And so we'll start inside at the downtown library. So we're saying, you know, the best age range for this program is 8 and up. But come by and check it out. It'll be pretty fun with all the rockets being built and launched tomorrow.
And you're still working on the plans for the new library out the road by selling bricks.
That's right. We do have the bricks for sale. You can you don't even have to come into the library, but you can come in and pick up a form and fill it out and pay for it right there in cash or check at the library, any of the three branches. Or you can go online and find an online format that you can pay with the credit card, too, and fill that out. So that's going to be ongoing through the end of the year at least. We have, I think, over 2,100 bricks or something like that to sell. So we're just getting underway with that, so we're pretty excited.
All right, Beth Weigel, thank you so much for coming down to the station here.
Great, and just don't forget that it's time to register to vote for the general election. So October 5th, the library is a voting, registered voting place.
Right, thanks for reminding us, Beth.
Now the town to see the home. How can a heart get chills?
From Blind Pig Records, Cena Earhart, called Chill to the Bone, and that's what the forecast for this weekend, it seems like. In the studio with me now is Ariel Rolfe, here to talk about things going on with the Arts and Humanities Council and beyond. Ariel, thank you for coming down the station today.
Thanks for having me. So I'm also here with our newest employee, Jason, and we're going to go through the arts.
Before we get too much, Jason, say hi on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Okay, now you say you've been on the radio and you know. I could say you've been on the radio in June.
Yeah, that's true.
Claim to fame. So, we've got all sorts of things coming up here, getting full into the fall arts scene, and it's really exciting. Tonight, we actually have, from 5 to 6:30, a poetry omnibus writing workshop with Emily Wall. So that'll be really fun. For more information, you can call us at the Jack or look on the community calendar at jack.org, J-H-C.org. Then at 6:30 to 9 at the Silver Bow is an event called Wild Shots, and it's an opportunity for everybody to share their favorite wilderness stories and photos, and it's in celebration of the Wilderness Act, the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. Out at Suite 907, there's Tango Thursdays at 7 to 9. Let's see. Tomorrow, there's all sorts of things going on, too. Starting at 11 till 2 o'clock, there's homemade soup luncheon at the Salvation Army Church Kitchen downtown, and that's a fundraising event. I heard they're going to have clam chowder and homemade bread and really good stuff there. And then from 1 to 3, there's a really fun event going on at the Juneau Public Library called Science Friday at the Library. Yes, it is rocket science. And I was reading the description, and they're going to have a video chat with Seattle Museum of Flight people, and then they're going to test rockets with a little egg. So that'll be a really fun event. And the age is 8 and up. And then from 4 to 6, STEM is doing their after-school workshop, and that's 8 and up as well. And they do that every Friday and Saturday, and you'll have to register the week prior. So I thought I'd mention it today, and then next week you can get your kids in. They're also accepting volunteers right now. And so you can call 523-2342 if you're interested, or go to stemak.org. And then, let's see, also going on tomorrow night is Arabic music and dance showcase here at K2, and that's 7 to 9, and that's featuring Daughters of the New Moon, the Noodle of Doom, guest dancers, and then the workshop instructor, Karim Nagy. And it's $15 at the door or $12 at Rainy Retreat. And then Dan Hobson is going to be playing at the Baranoff Hotel in the Gold Room from 7 to 9. And he plays every week, and that makes it for a really nice meal, a good dinner date. And then Saturday, there's a few fun things going on as well. We've got the GCI Tech Quest Scavenger Hunt from 1 to 3. And that starts at Marine Park, and it's a free family event, and it's going to be a scavenger hunt in downtown Juneau. They're giving away all sorts of prizes.
I heard five of the prizes are round-trip tickets to Alaska.
Yeah, it's crazy. So you guys need to get down there and do it.
They're giving basketballs away to all the kids.
Yeah, all sorts of really fun prizes. So that's at Marine Park. It starts at 1 o'clock. And they can look it up online, too, at gci.com/techquest, T-E-C-H-Q-U-E-S-T. And then at 6 o'clock to 11 o'clock is the Bartlett Foundation Seafood Gala and Fundraiser, and that's the Roaring Twenties Soiree. And you can find your tickets at the Jack or at Hearthside, or you can go online to brhfoundation.org. Let's see. And then Sunday, there's the weekly ukulele jam at TK McGuire's here in the Prospector Hotel right next door, and that's 11 to 1 on Sunday. And there's also, let's see, Juno Jumper tryout practice from 2 to 5 in the Glacier Valley Gym. And then, let's see, the next week we're kind of... accidentally printed all of my other stuff too. So next week we have the quilt show starts on Tuesday here at K2.
It's only on Tuesday, but you can come down to K2 during business hours. We're not going to do reception this year, but
yeah, I saw that.
They will be available for viewing.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And then First Friday starts, but we'll talk about that next Thursday.
Lots of stuff going on. Ariel, yeah, I'm even involved in roundtable discussions. Do you want to give an update of what's been happening?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So roundtable has been a really fun, exciting monthly community meeting out the Jack that I help facilitate. And we're going through all sorts of fun projects that have been bubbling up. I invite all of the artists in the community and art organization representatives come in as well, and we talk about different arts projects in Juneau or potential art projects. And some of the things that have come up are forming a group of people to review local art shows and talk about those in the newspaper. And then we have another program going on we're trying to organize a fall studio event, an open studio event for people. I think the fall one will be in November, and details are to be determined. But that'll be probably downtown for the first one. And then in the spring, we're hoping to get out to the Valley Studios as well. And then we're also looking into different ways to get more involved in the arts community in Juneau and see what we can do in the Valley and just to involve a lot of different people. So great conversations, and the next meeting is on the 14th, and we're going to hear from Melanie Shivens about the newest Southeast Alaska Arts Economy Survey, and she's going to present the results from that, which are really exciting.
All right, now all that's happening at the roundtable discussions, which again are every...
They're the third Tuesday of every month, except for this month, when they'll be on the 14th.
All right, Ariel, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
We're just super busy. And if you want to check out what's happening, I didn't get to mention everything, but we always list on our community calendar online, and that's www.jahc.org. And there's always new things going in. So look there.
Ariel, thank you very much for coming by. And Josh, Jason, thank you for coming by.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tonight on 360 North, watch 2 hours of news and Alaska weather beginning at 6. At 8 o'clock, progressive American soul artist Harrison B. performs and talks about his music on Alaska Originals. At 9, AARP Alaska offers answers to gifting and estate questions. The Aviators is at 9:30. Rain Country Reflections moves to a new time at 10, followed by Alaska Magazine Television at 10:30. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Time is 3:55 and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau. Tonight's Rob Cohen Jazz Group concert at 360 is sold out. A waiting list will be started at 6:30 on a first-come, first-served basis in case there are any no-shows. For those of you who can't make it, don't worry. The concert will be available on 360north.org and KRNN-FM later on in the future. In tonight's Robert Cohen Jazz Group concert is sold out. A waiting list will be started at 6:30 on a first-come, first-served basis.
City has more than 7,000 old payphones hanging around with cell phones everywhere these days. What's the city going to do with all of them?
The city wants to turn all of them into Wi-Fi hotspots.
But why are they doing that? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and each week on Marketplace Weekend, we explain why people are doing whatever they're doing with their money. Join us right here for Marketplace Weekend from 8 p.m.
Sunday afternoons at 5 on KTUO News Juno.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait.